This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscoane. We're taking a look at parenting this hour. When was the last time you heard a parent say something like this to a child? No, you can't go out tonight. Why? Because I said so. For many of us, that laying down of the law might seem like a quaint throwback. The 2016 version might go something like, no, you can't go out tonight. Why? You'll be tired for school tomorrow. You won't be able to get to soccer. You won't be able to get your homework done. So we negotiate, and sometimes, maybe often, the child wins the negotiation. Well, experts might disagree on the value of either choice, but today's guest is clear in his opinion. Leonard Sachs is a longtime family physician and holds a doctorate in psychology. He's also an author, and his latest work is called The Collapse of Parenting: How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Sachs says many parents suffer from what he calls role confusion. They abdicate authority and let kids call the shots, and in the end, it's the children who suffer. Leonard Sachs is in studio with us. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
So in your practice, Leonard, what did you observe that led you to write a book about changes in or what you believe to be a collapse in parenting?
Oh, absolutely. So I've been a medical doctor for 30 years, and here's a situation that comes up all the time that came up recently. Mom brings her daughter in to be seen. Daughter is 6 years old, has a fever and a sore throat. And I look at her ears, they're fine. And then I say, okay, let's look at your throat and do a strep test. But before I can do that, Mom says, is it okay if the doctor looks at your throat? And then afterwards, we'll go get ice cream. And the daughter looks at Mom and thinks this over and then says, no, I don't want to. And what should have been a 10-second procedure becomes a 5-minute ordeal requiring an assistant to restrain the child. Look, there are some situations where it's fine for kids to decide. But if your child has a fever and a sore throat and they're at the doctor's office, they're going to get a strep test. They don't get a vote.
So what should the parent have done, in your opinion?
The parent should have said, open wide and say, ah. There are so many situations like that. For example, is it okay for a kid to have a phone in their bedroom, a cell phone in their bedroom when they're in bed at night? The answer is no, it's not okay. But many parents let kids decide, and they might lay out the argument, say, well, you know, you'll get a better night's sleep, but the kid will say, no, I use it as my alarm clock. I want to have it in my phone. And so this girl's getting a text at 2 a.m. Oh, my goodness. Jason and Sonia have broken up. This is really big news. We all have to talk about it. And they're exchanging texts for an hour in the middle of the night. And the parents don't even know this is happening. And the daughter is sleep deprived because she's been up for an hour in the middle of the night exchanging text messages. Mm-hmm. It is the parent's job to take the phone from the child at 9 o'clock, the very latest, switch the phone off and put it in the charger, which stays in the parent's bedroom. You can have it back tomorrow morning. Look, what is this girl supposed to say? 14-year-old girl, what's she supposed to say tomorrow in school when her friend says, hey, I texted you last night at midnight. How come you didn't answer? Is she supposed to say, well, researchers have found that sleep deprivation is a major risk factor in depression? Come on, that's ridiculous. You have to allow her to say, hey, my evil parents take my phone every night at 9, and we'll only have it back till the next morning. It is the parent's job. No one else can do this.
Yeah. Things have changed since you and I came up. There were no cell phones, obviously, no cell phones in the bedroom. And the kid, you know, the child, the teenager might say to the parent, but, you know, what if I miss? They are missing out in their minds on a whole world. It removes them socially from their circle of friends. How do you respond to that?
There are choices, and the child is not competent to make that choice. The pros and cons of having a phone in the bedroom. The parent understands. Look, the rules of good parenting haven't changed in 20 years. 20 years ago, a girl could not accept a phone call at 2 a.m. because the phone would ring and the parents would hear and they wouldn't allow it because the parents understood it's more important to get a good night's sleep than to be up gossiping at 2 a.m. That was true 20 years ago. It's still true today. The only thing that has changed is the technology. It's the parents' job. It is not fair to put that burden in the lap of your 14-year-old because she's a kid and she will do what the other kids are doing. And the cool kids are texting at 2 a.m. and she wants to be one of the cool kids. It's the parents' job to ensure their kid gets a good night's sleep.
Are parents willing to take on the mantle of evil parent in this day and age, are you finding?
It depends. Depends on the parents. Parents who speak English at home and who have above average incomes are, in my experience, less willing. And I say that not just of the Philadelphia area, but across the United States. Parents who speak an East Asian or South Asian language at home are much more comfortable saying no phones in the bedroom. But you know what? Even that white parent who speaks English at home, when you explain to them the risks and the benefits, they can change. And I tell those parents, sit down with your kids. Don't try and do this cute or subtle. Just say, look, we've been doing some things wrong. I've been doing some things wrong. And we're going to make some changes. No more phones in the bedroom. No more devices at the dinner table. There will be no screens at the dinner table. When we're at the dinner table, we're going to listen to one another and not be looking at our phones. No more earbuds in the car. When we're in the car, we're going to listen to one another. I'll listen to you, and you will listen to me, not to Justin Bieber or Akon or Lady Gaga.
Yeah, we're going to flesh this all out as we go through the hour, but let's get back to sleep for a moment. As you know, it's generally accepted that sleep is not valued as much, perhaps, as it should be, you know, by adults as well as children. What is the value of sleep to a young person?
I go into that question at great length in the book, beginning with a chapter on obesity. Why are so many kids obese today? In 1971, 4% of 4% of American kids were obese. Today, 17% of American kids are obese. And there are several factors driving them. One of those factors is the decline in sleep time. American teens get between 60 and 90 minutes less sleep than American teens were getting 20 years ago, and that is not universal. In the UK, British teens are getting a little bit more sleep than they were getting 20 years ago.
Are there no cell phones in the bedrooms
they
of British teens?
I've got the citations there in the book to show that British teens are just as connected, just as wired, just as likely to have mobile phones as American teens are. The difference is the parents. British parents are much more likely to turn the phones off. American parents are much more likely to let kids have phone in the bedroom.
So there is a connection between a lack of sleep and overweight.
There is a very robust and kind of counterintuitive connection between lack of sleep and overweight. I remember when I first read these papers many years ago that showed that sleep deprivation predicts overweight. It was like, well, that's strange. You would think that whatever you're doing when you're not sleeping is going to burn more calories than when you're sleeping. But it turns out when you're sleep deprived, your brain gets all confused and you get the munchies and you got to have potato chips or you got to have ice cream and you got to have it. Whereas if you're well rested, you make better food choices. You're much less likely to have those cravings. So that's one of multiple factors driving this increase in obesity. Another one is the fact that parents used to decide what's for supper. And today, many parents let kids decide. I was speaking to parents in Chappaqua, New York, and a husband and wife had made a healthy, nutritious supper for their son and daughter. And the son and daughter came home and said, "Ooh, yuck, we don't want to eat that. Can we just order pizza?" And so father sat down at the computer and ordered Domino's pizza to the specifications dictated to him by his children. And I said to him, "Why'd you do that? Why didn't you just tell them this is what's for supper?" And he said, "Well, I don't believe in using starvation as a means of discipline." I said, "They're not going to starve. Look, 30 years ago, if mom made a healthy and nutritious supper and the kids didn't want to eat it, she didn't run out and order pizza. She would tell them this is what's for supper. If you don't like it, you can go to bed hungry." But today, many parents, not all, are very reluctant to do that. And if you look,
why?
What
do you attribute this cultural change?
Why are parents today less comfortable asserting their authority? I think that political sensibilities have infiltrated the home.
How so?
So 50 years ago, Americans trusted authority and institutions like the presidency or the Catholic Church were held in high regard. We've got actually very good data on this showing that Americans don't trust institutional authority anymore. And I don't have a problem with that. I'm not suggesting you should trust the president. I mean, between Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton lying to us, how are you supposed to trust the president? I'm not suggesting that we should go back to the bad old days. But what happened is that distrust of authority became part of the American mindset. And it's now very difficult for parents to say, "No, you can't have pizza for supper because I'm your mom, and I said so. Parents are very reluctant to say that. Parents are very reluctant to say things like, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Instead, it morphs into a question, and the question becomes, well, how would you feel if someone did that to you? The statement has turned into a question, and the parent has no answer when the kid responds, if someone did that to me, I'd kick him in the nuts, and then I'd sit on his face.
Well, so you're saying that in rejecting authority, parents are also rejecting their role as authoritarians.
They're authoritative. It's an important distinction in the literature. Parents, yes, indeed, are undermining their own authority. And I have seen parents, and the parent and child are in the office together, and the parent is saying, is it okay if the doctor does this? And I say to the parent, don't speak with question marks. Speak in declarative sentences. Please have a seat on the table. Open your mouth and say, ah. Don't end every question, every sentence in a question mark, as so many parents do, and they'll catch themselves and they realize it's become a bad habit. Everything ends in a question mark.
Okay. You also, let's get back to sleep deprivation for just a moment. And actually, we're up against a break here in a moment or so. So you say sleep deprivation mimics ADHD almost perfectly?
Of the inattentive variety, yes.
Yeah.
So a girl did well in elementary school, well in middle school, and high school. Her grades dropped off, and the parents took her to a child psychiatrist who looked at Connor scales from the teachers and said, well, let's try Vyvanse and see if it helps, and it was tremendously helpful. But she got side effects, palpitations and jitteriness. So the parents had seen something I wrote in the New York Times about this, so they brought her in to see me, and I did a more careful sleep history. The parents said, well, she's in her bedroom at 9, doesn't come out till 6 the next morning, and I asked her, well, what do you do in your bedroom? Well, she's got a mobile phone, and she's on Instagram till midnight or later. Sleep deprivation can perfectly mimic ADHD of the inattentive variety. You have trouble concentrating, have trouble focusing, have trouble paying attention. And what is Vyvanse? What are Adderall? They're amphetamines. They're speed. They will compensate for the sleep deprivation, and it looks like it's helping, but the appropriate remedy for sleep deprivation is sleep, not Schedule II stimulants.
So Leonard Sachs, are you saying then that children in this country are overdiagnosed when it comes to ADHD?
Oh, we know that. Yes, absolutely. I'm saying that. And in another chapter of the book, I compare the numbers. A kid in this country is 14 times more likely to be on medication for ADHD compared to a kid in the United Kingdom.
So, and again, it comes back to the parents simply saying cell phones off and to bed at 10 o'clock. And
it's not just that. I explore that.
You don't want to oversimplify.
Because there are multiple factors which I address, but I was talking to a family that had spent 4 years in England, and then they came back. Their son was 8 years old, and he was doing okay in school. But mom told me when she came back to this country, the parents and the teachers are saying, why don't you have him evaluated? Maybe he should be on medication.
We're going to pick up on that in just a moment. Leonard Sachs is a longtime family physician and author of The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Our guest this hour is a family physician, psychologist, and author. Leonard Sachs has written The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And going into the break, Leonard Sachs, we were talking about psychiatric disorders like ADHD, the possible link to sleep deprivation. And I guess the next question is, you know, if a parent is told by an educator or even perhaps a physician that the child might suffer from this disorder, which incidentally was diagnosed a lot less frequently, 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
What is the first thing that parent should do? Because you want to trust the professional.
You do. But I've got a chapter on that in my book, The Collapse of Parenting. Why are so many kids on medication? For ADHD, for example, in 1979, 1% of American kids were diagnosed with ADHD. Latest numbers from the CDC, 10% of American teenage girls, 20% of American teenage boys diagnosed with ADHD. And in the chapter, I compare this to other countries. I already mentioned American kids 14 times more likely to be on medication for ADD compared to kids in the United Kingdom. American kids 40 times more likely to be medicated for bipolar disorder compared to kids in Germany. American kids 93 times more likely to be on medications like Risperdal, Zyprexa, and Seroquel.
Which are powerful meds.
Which are used to control behavior compared to kids in Italy.
But you say that our kids are not necessarily getting sicker over the last few decades.
Well, what's happened? Why has there been this explosion in psychiatric diagnosis? And one of the arguments I make in the book, and I think I support it pretty well with the published evidence, is that parents have abdicated their own authority, and instead there's now a vacuum. This kid's not behaving in school. And 30 years ago, the teacher, the principal might have said, hey, your son is rude. He's defiant. He's disrespectful. He talks back. And the burden was on the parent to step up and teach your son to behave. But now the same behavior, there are kids who misbehave everywhere. And
sure.
I visited schools in Australia, New Zealand, England, Scotland. Kids misbehave everywhere. But in this country, and not outside North America, when a kid misbehaves, it is very common today for a teacher or administrator to say, hey, have you thought of having your son evaluated? Maybe he would benefit from medication. And if you go to an American child psychiatrist, they are very likely to start a medication like Risperdal, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Adderall, Vyvanse, which may indeed control the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But the appropriate remedy for a misbehaving child is for the parent to step up. And I've had kids themselves say to me, well, I have Asperger's, I can't help it. They use the diagnosis as an excuse for bad behavior.
So again, back to the question, though, when a parent is presented this opinion by a professional and they're not sure, what do they do? I mean, you don't necessarily want to avoid a diagnosis that might help the child.
Well, that's why, at the risk of sounding commercial, what they should do is read my book, or at least that chapter from the book, because that chapter is written for that parent so that you can ask the appropriate questions. Because I've spoken to child psychiatrists as well. And the psychiatrist often will say, look, the parent is coming into my office. They're expecting a prescription. And I write the prescription and everyone's happy. If I say, look, the problem here is not with your child, but with your parenting. You have not created firm moral structures for this child to understand. That's an hour-long visit. I'm likely to get negative comments on my Google. When people Google my name, they'll see some nasty comment from a parent who was expecting a medication and got a lecture instead. That's happened to me. So I tell the parent, explain to the doctor that you don't want to use medication as a first resort, that medication should be a last resort, and that you'd like guidance and counsel about what you can do other than medication, because you'll find the doctor can offer many suggestions to help this kid step up. Okay, so there's a diagnosis. Asperger's is not an excuse for bad behavior. Asperger's is a reason for you to lean in, not to step back.
Okay, we've got lots of calls coming in. let's go to Jim in Mount Airy. Hello, Jim. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm the single dad of a five-year-old, about to be five-year-old. Two things. First, I often start with do something because I'm your father and I said so. What I've found is that it seems to me that it's helpful once things settle down and he's, you know, doing what I asked him to do, that I will add an explanation. He seems to respond to reason and to understanding things. So I'd like to know if that's helpful or harmful. Secondly, because he is in two households, I'm already running into situations where I'm more strict than his mom, and I'll tell him not to do something, and he says, well, mama always lets me do that. So how do I respond to that in a way that does not undermine his relationship with his mother?
Okay, two questions.
Two
Thanks,
great
Jim.
Points. The first question, I absolutely endorse explanation. So your kid's home, they're hungry, you're about to have dinner. You say, look, no, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to pig out on ice cream right before supper because it will ruin your appetite for supper and you're less likely to eat the healthy things. To your teenage son, no, you're not allowed to look at pornography because it objectifies women, because it creates unrealistic expectations. But you're explaining, you're not negotiating. So I'm all in favor of explanation. The second point...
Quickly, before you get to the second point, how do you prevent that from morphing into negotiation?
At some point,
they'll
say,
well, you know, I'll be able to eat dinner if I have that ice cream. I'll eat my whole, you know, finish the entire plate.
And then you may have to say, I'm sorry, that's not happening.
Okay.
The second point that you raised is so valid and so important and so difficult. Mother and father, both parents, have to agree on the essentials. And I have personally seen so many families where the parents have divorced and it is a race to the bottom, the race to be the more permissive parents, especially as the kid gets older. Parents know that the judge will take the kid's preference into account. And if the kid says, I hate my dad because he's strict, I want to be with my mom because she likes me. At age 13, the judge may say, okay, you can spend all your time with your mom. And parents know this. So what I encourage you to do is you must arrange a meeting, not face-to-face with your wife. If you could get along with your wife, you wouldn't have divorced her. It has to be with a marriage counselor or some other professional. And both of you are looking at the marriage counselor and saying, okay, we need to agree on some rules which will be enforced in both households. You might not agree on everything, but you have to agree on the basics.
Let's get to the family dinner and the value of sitting around the table. So hard for so many of us with crazy schedules and sports and music. And perhaps somebody comes from, you know, everybody's coming home from work at a different time.
Yep.
But you say work around this somehow. And why is that?
Yes. So I cite a study of more than 10,000 adolescents coast to coast where they said, okay, in the last 7 days, how many days have you had an evening meal at home with a parent? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And they found that for each increase, not from between 0 and 7 just, but between 5 and 6 suppers a week, with each increase in the number of meals that a kid is having at home with a parent, there's a significant decrease in anxiety and depression, a significant increase in life satisfaction and pro-social behavior, and it is significant at each step. So you've got to fight for supper at home, and yet what has happened in the last 20 years? I said another study, different researchers, where they asked teenagers in 1992, in the last 24 hours, have you had a meal at home with a parent? In 1992, two-thirds of teenagers said, yes, I have. But now, when you ask teenagers, in the last 24 hours, have you had a meal at home with a parent? Two-thirds of teenagers said, no, I haven't. That's a big change.
Yeah.
So we've gone from a culture in which the family meal was the norm to a culture in which it's not. And parents are driving their kids around from one activity to the next. And the unintended message they're sending is that time at home with family is the lowest priority. And I tell parents, cancel the play date. Have a meal at home instead.
All right. We've got, again, lots of calls and emails, tweets coming in. We've got an email from Eric who asks, can your guest discuss how we can best respect authority while also learning which authority to reject?
Mm-hmm.
What if a parent tells a child to do something dangerous or questionable?
Well, I think he's making a real good point, which is that as I said before, I'm not endorsing a return to the bad old days where people, where many Americans accepted without question the authority of the president and other authority figures. But what is appropriate in our dealings with one another as adults is not necessarily best for what's true for kids in the home. And there's so much confusion on this point. People think, well, you know, I don't give orders to my wife. I don't give orders to my colleagues, so I shouldn't give orders to my child. But again, appropriate behavior between two adults is not what kids need. What do kids need? What's childhood for? That's the opening chapter. What is childhood for? It's ridiculously long in our species. In our species, childhood lasts longer than the lives of many other mammals. A horse, a bigger animal than a human, is fully mature at 4 years of age. A four-year-old child is just getting started. Why is childhood so long? Well, researchers have looked at this and have thought about this and have studied this, and the answer the researchers give is that childhood is as long as it is in our species because culture takes a long time for a parent to teach.
Interesting.
That's what childhood is for. It is the job of the parent to inculcate the appropriate culture in the child. But many parents have stepped back. And kids, like all human children, are looking for culture. But if the parent is not firmly and authoritatively teaching the child the parent's culture, the kid will look to the internet, to social media, and they're learning from Akon, Justin Bieber, Justin Timberlake, Miley Cyrus. You don't want those figures to be teaching your child right and wrong. You must do it.
What of the common sentiment? I would guess it's common that, you know, if I'm too authoritative, my child will not love me.
I share that concern. And so I've got a whole nother chapter in the book titled Enjoy. You need to be, most of the time with your kid should be fun time, should be laughing time. And again, American parents have prioritized same age relationships over building the relationship between parent and child. So when you're planning a vacation and your daughter asks, can I bring along my best friend with me? The answer is no. The point of the vacation is to strengthen the bond between you and your child. It needs to be you and her going up on the chairlift together.
And then if that child is 13, you might have a sullen child next to you on the
Well, and I tell parents, you know, I say, look, plan a long car trip to the Poconos or wherever. And no phones allowed on the car trip. In the first 20 minutes, she may be very sullen because you're not allowing her to use her phone. But you know what? She will start talking because there's nothing else to do. And that is the point of the vacation. It's for you and her to connect, for you and her to have a good time together, not for her and her friend to have a good time together. Otherwise, it's just an expensive play date.
All right. Eric in Germantown is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Eric.
Yes, I was calling because the guest was not making a distinction, which is a very important one historically, between authoritarian parenting and authoritative parenting. Some of the things he said earlier in the interview actually sounded more authoritarian than authoritative. The big difference is, I mean, leaving aside time constraints, it's important to explain why you're giving a directive,
yeah,
if at all possible. It does not in any way logically lead to negotiation if you actually know better than the child. But the fact is, number one, you're actually teaching the child something the child can use as an adult. Number two, you're modeling, not being irrational and doing things on a whim, but always having a good reason for what you're doing. And I'm glad that the guest eventually acknowledged that, but only after a caller brought the question up. And one shouldn't even say in the first place that in general it's okay to say, because I said so.
Right.
Sometimes time constraints may require that, but in general that's not a good idea.
Eric, thank you for the call to Radio Times.
My own parents were authoritative, not authoritarian.
Right. Define the
yes.
difference.
So I talk a lot in the book about the work of Dan Baumrind, who coined and explained those terms authoritarian, authoritative, and permissive. And in the book, I instead use the term too hard, too soft, and just right. Authoritarian is too hard. Authoritative is just right. Now, we all want to be just right parents. We don't want to be too hard. But what is too hard? What is authoritarian versus authoritative? And Anna Baumrind actually has weighed in on this, and I cite her comments in the book. And she said, over the last 20 years, American parents have shifted from authoritative to permissive. And what many American parents today think is just right parenting is permissive parenting by the standards of 20 years ago. And she has emphasized that the best parent is both strict and loving. And again, many American parents today perceive a tension. They think you can be either strict or loving. But Dr. Baumrind's research, conducted over many decades now, watching how these kids grow up, shows that the best parents are both strict and loving. So as the caller said, you offer an explanation, but you don't negotiate.
And back to the phones. Harry in Lansdale, you're live. Hello, Harry.
How are you?
Well, thank you. What's your question or comment?
I was talking earlier about with your screener about child rebellion and how we saw that in a lot of our friends' kids, but not in ours. And there are two things that we emphasized. One was that we would sacrifice our time and our purposes in life as we raised our children for their needs, which we saw in our forefathers, kind of, and we didn't see it in our peers, where they had their own identities and their own drives that needed to be satisfied, but we worked with our kids in, you know, difficult subjects and other areas of their life they struggled in, kind of at the cost of our time, which they appreciated, and as they grew into adulthood, they loved that fact. And second was, privilege was something they earned and they exercised, and as they grew in privilege and showed responsibility, we gave them more. If they didn't succeed in that privilege, we reduced it, coached, and let them reenter that. So their world opened up into adulthood rather than giving them all the privilege and then start taking it away until they were 17 or 18 and then rebelling because their world narrowed because we were trying to control them.
Okay.
We let them embrace the world.
I'm up against the clock here a little bit, Harry. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. So inoculating children against rebellion. Does Harry have some points?
I think he's got a good point, which is that your child needs to know that your child is your first priority. And again, many parents, if you're at the dinner table and you're looking at your phone, checking an email.
So tempting.
Put your phone away when you're with your child. The child should have your undivided attention, no screens. And again, the caller's making another good point, which is that he's seeing better outcomes in his kids than his neighbors are. And I hear from parents who say, oh, I can't take my phone away from my kid. They'll just freak out. And I say to them, look, your neighbor is doing this. You can do this. You need to do what's best for your kid.
Okay, we have time for one more comment before the break. The Walkman has been available since the 80s. This is from Ben. Kids have been listening to their own music during car rides for decades now. This isn't a new phenomenon or a sign of the collapse of parenting. Do you have any evidence, or are you just going to continue to speak in anecdotes? Actually, we have about 10 seconds here, and then we can continue afterwards.
Well, there's over 400 scholarly citations in the book, so yes, it's a great deal of evidence to support this.
All right, more on that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. And our guest this hour is Leonard Sachs, a family physician, psychologist, and author whose latest book is called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grownups. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email as well at radiotimes at whyy.org or a tweet at whyy Radio Times. Leonard Sachs, education. You write that 30 years ago, when a child entered kindergarten or first grade, the emphasis was not necessarily on learning to read and to do early math. It was on socialization. Give us a quick sketch, if you would, of Fulghum's rules.
Right.
Some of us remember that.
So Robert Fulghum, 30 years ago, had a best-selling book titled All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, sold more than 15 million copies. And he said, look, what did you learn in kindergarten? Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. And that was true enough for his experience in kindergarten and for his kids' experience. But even as he was writing, the kindergarten experience was changing. And the emphasis in the late 80s and into the 90s shifted to literacy and numeracy. In other words, kindergarten became first grade. And the focus and the objective of kindergarten in most schools nationwide became on learning to read, write, and do arithmetic. And socialization became and teaching what I call Fulghum's rules, share everything, play fair, don't hit people, took a back seat. Because in that era, the culture was teaching it. And educators thought, well, we can focus on phonics and such they didn't explicitly say we don't need to worry about socialization. They just said, hey, earlier is better, right, as far as literacy and numeracy goes. But the result is that, look, no kid is born knowing these rules. They have to be taught. Different cultures have had different rules. These rules are not universal. And the result is that you will find many kids now in elementary school who just don't get it. And I just heard from a head of school who said the parents are relying on us to teach the rules of good behavior and courtesy, but it's the parents' job, and the parents are not doing their job. And as a result, the classroom is becoming unmanageable.
So in part, though, do you think there should be a change in early childhood education in terms of focus?
Well, I'm speaking as a clinician. Mm. I work with parents. I'm not the Secretary of Education. So as I say to parents and to teachers, I just spoke to teachers yesterday at Lehigh Valley, it is not in our power to change what's going to happen in kindergarten. Our focus is on the individual child. So what I say to the parent is, look, you must teach the rules of courtesy and good behavior and what we expect of a lady or a gentleman, because the school will not teach it. It's your job. And the culture will not teach it. And that's a big shift, because in American culture, again, this is not a guess. We've got good evidence here. You look at the most popular programs in the 1960s, like the Andy Griffith Show, Family Ties in the 1980s. They actually taught courtesy and respect, that kids were to be respectful towards adults. But contemporary culture, whether it's The Simpsons or the Disney Channel, doesn't teach it. On the contrary, it actively undermines it. The most popular shows on the Disney Channel, like Dog with a Blog, Liv and Maddie, Jesse, teach kids to be disrespectful. The kids are laughing at the parents. The kids are disrespecting the parents. And we, the audience, are supposed to laugh along with them at the idiotic, clueless, out-of-touch parents.
So how does a parent counteract that?
Turn off the Disney Channel, for one thing.
That's tough to do.
You can do it. We do it in our home, and I encourage you. I'm not saying turn off television.
Yeah.
You know, the Animal Planet has lots of great programs for kids, but the Disney Channel does not.
So when a child goes to a playmate's house and they watch the Disney Channel.
No, you call the parent first, and you explain to the parent, I don't want my child to watch the Disney Channel. And if the parent says, well, I have no idea what the kids are watching. They're in one room, I'm in another. Then you say to your child, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to go to that house.
And risk being, do you really
risk being less popular?
Less
yes, indeed.
Popular.
And I talk about that. Mm. Many American parents think that being popular is a priority. And I cite in the book a longitudinal cohort study when they found that being the most popular kid at age 13 was a major risk factor for anxiety, depression, and lower wages at age 23. The American culture has become what I call a culture of disrespect. Homer Simpson has replaced the Andy Griffith Show. And that culture of disrespect, being the most popular kid at age 13, very often means that you are defiant, you're disrespectful towards adults, and that's not a good life skill. So you explain to your kid, you're not going to be the most popular kid.
Back to the phones. To Pineville we go, and Andrew, welcome to Radio Times, Andrew.
Well, thank you. I've always been intrigued by this subject, and I find that kids, especially the younger they are, they like guidance. They like hearing the word no. And I don't think enough emphasis is being put on how the parents, they have to work all day, both parents usually. Then they come home, and then they don't want to deal with it anymore. They say, okay, we'll give you your chicken tenders or your pizza or your fettuccine Alfredo, and we'll eat regular food. And I think it all started when I'm 64 years old, and my generation was the first time that both parents went to work full time. And when they got home, not only were they tired, but oftentimes they felt guilty. So they just wanted to give the kids whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted.
Andrew, thanks.
There was no dinner time, and I think that's one of the big reasons. Parents are a bunch of wusses.
Well, thank you for your comment. Aside from Andrew's thoughts about what parents are or might be, the fact is, In many families, both parents have to work.
Mm-hmm.
Work is exhausting. Parenting
sure.
is exhausting.
Yes.
You get home at the end of the day, and sometimes it's just easier to put the chicken tenders out.
Well, this is where comparisons with other countries are really useful, because what you find is that in Switzerland, in Scotland, the rate of single parenting is as high as it is in this country, and yet they don't have these problems. Single parents can do this. Single parenting is not the cause of this problem. It is the American abdication of authority. You have to be the parent, and I certainly understand and sympathize. It's harder for a single parent. My mom was a single mom with three boys, and I saw how difficult it is. But you can be a good parent. Parents in Switzerland, parents in Scotland, I've spoken on this topic in those countries. I've met with parents in both countries. They parent with authority. American parents are much less comfortable exercising authority, and that's the root cause of the problem.
What is the value of consistency?
Well, again, the just right parent is loving but strict. And so you explain the rules and you stand by the rules, but sometimes you have to bend the rules a little bit, but you have to enforce the culture of respect. So in a just right way, it's fine for your child to disagree with you. It's fine for your child to say, hey, Dad, you're wrong, and here's why I think you're wrong. That's fine. But it is never acceptable for a child to say, you don't know what the you're talking about. That's not allowed.
What is the value of being your child's best friend?
Okay, we get tangled up in the words a little bit here, because every parent wants to be on a friendly basis with their child. Every parent wants to be, every good parent, I think, wants to be their child's confidant, and that's as it should be. But a friend is a peer. A friend cannot command another friend. Your friend cannot say to you, I won't allow you to watch pornography. I won't allow you to take your phone to bed with you. I won't allow you to have ice cream right before supper. But a parent can say those things, and only a parent can say those things, and a parent must say those things. There are many kids out there who can be your kid's best friend, but only you can be the parent.
Back to the phones. Nancy in Center City. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. The things that this guest is saying are things that I have observed myself among my younger friends and younger relatives. I'm in my 60s, and when it was time for dinner, I put food on the table. And now, generally, kids were allowed to maybe say that they didn't want to eat one thing. But I see now kids who live on pizza, chicken nuggets, and sugary foods, and I really worry about their health. You know, they seem to be making their way okay through childhood, but I wonder what will happen to them when they're, if they continue eating like that, when they're in their 20s or beyond.
Okay, good question. Thanks for the call to Radio Time. So telescope this out for us.
Well, I actually begin the book with a situation like the caller describes, again, in my own office. Mom, it happens to be an affluent family, brings her daughter and says she's got this cracking rash and they've tried some creams and it hasn't helped. And I recognize the rash as a sign of vitamin deficiency. And I said, well, how good is your daughter at eating broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, spinach, and asparagus? And the daughter laughed, and Mom said, well, she won't eat those things. She'll only eat pizza, French fries. And the daughter interrupted and said, it has to be McDonald's French fries, potato chips, and ice cream. Look, most kids are not competent to decide what's for supper. Good habits develop as a matter of habit. My daughter loves broccoli and spinach and asparagus because that's what she's been in the habit of eating.
Is it true that if you try it enough that you will develop a taste for it?
Yes. If you keep trying, you keep offering it to the child. And again, my daughter loves healthy vegetables because we all eat them and that's what we eat. But many parents give up too easily. Again, they're uncomfortable asserting their authority. They think that just right parenting means you offer choices. But if you offer a 9-year-old a choice between spinach and French fries, they're going to choose French fries. So parents have stepped back from their authority.
Leonard Sachs, I've noticed the word fragile creeping into the lexicon regarding children. And you ask, why are so many kids so fragile or seemingly fragile? Give us an example of fragility.
Another chapter in the book. I describe kids who look fine, feel fine, and then one little thing happens. This girl isn't invited to a party, and it's just a catastrophe, and she's in tears, hysterical, sobbing. Why are kids so fragile? 50 years ago, the Johns Hopkins sociologist, Dr. Coleman, interviewed kids across the United States and asked them, If all your friends wanted you to join a particular club, but one of your parents didn't approve, would you still join? And two generations back, the majority of American teenagers said, no, I wouldn't join. I have asked an updated version of the same question to many kids at many venues across the United States. I asked them, if all your friends wanted you to join a particular social media site, would you consult your parents first? And the most common answer I get is laughter. One girl said, why would I ask my parents? They probably think Ask FM is some kind of radio station. Yeah. If kids value what other kids think more than they value what their parents think, they will be fragile because peer relations are contingent and ephemeral. My daughter could say to me, I hate you. I'm never going to talk to you ever again. And there would be consequences. She would lose some privileges, but nothing would really change. She knows that I will love her and that will not change, that her place in our home will not change. And she can relax in the knowledge that no matter what she says, she is still my beloved daughter. But if she says those same words to a friend, I hate you, I'm never going to talk to you ever again, that friendship is damaged, maybe destroyed. And so if your friendships with same age peers at age 9 or 14 is the most important thing in your life, you're going to be fragile. You're going to be checking the phone every 5 minutes because if there's a text message and you don't answer promptly, Sonia might think you don't like her anymore. And then Sonia's going to tell your friends that you're mean and you go from being the most popular girl to being the odd girl out in 5 minutes. And every girl has seen this happen. If peer relations matter more than parents, kids are fragile.
I think we've got time for one more call before the top of the hour. Deborah in Westchester, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for taking my call. Three quick comments, if I may, but not in any particular order. In terms of parents going to a clinician or a physician and having the physician say your child needs to be on medication, that's when I advocate, and I've been in this arena for 17 years, that parents go to a different physician because medication is not, nor should it be, the first choice. And it's also a parent's decision, not the school's decision, but the parent's decision. The second comment I'd like to make in terms of Asperger's or any other clinical diagnosis, no, it is not an excuse, but it is an explanation. And those explanations are absolutely critical for parents to understand their children and for schools to understand their children as well. And the third comment I'd like to make is this, and I write about this a lot. There's been too much parent bashing. Parents are not abdicating their responsibility. Parents are not being soft when it comes to parenting. Parents need to be cut a bit of a break. Parents have a very difficult job this year, pardon me, and in these years versus in the 1950s or even the 1980s. Parents need to be given some credit for being authoritative, for being able to communicate with their children, to give them options, to teach them respect. I've kind of reached my saturation point with parent bashing.
So Deborah, you think that in your observation that parents are authoritative enough in this culture?
Yes. Again, we can't make a commonality about everything, but yes. I work with parents nationwide, and parents are exerting their authority where it's necessary. They're not wusses. They're not sitting back.
Okay, we appreciate your call and your comments to Radio Time. We've got about 40 seconds left. Yeah. Leonard, your thoughts?
Well, certainly, if your experience is that the parents you see are just right, I'm not quarreling with you. My book is for the parent who is asking questions, who's wondering, why is my kid so disrespectful? Where are they getting this from? And what can I do to help my kid to be courteous, respectful, and enjoy life more? If you are that parent, then the book is for you. If your kids are doing great, then you don't need this book. This book is for parents who are trying to figure out why their child is going off in a different direction.
And on that note, Leonard Sachs, thank you so much for joining us for this hour of Radio Times.
Thank you.
Leonard is author of The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grownups. And as always, don't forget to check out our Facebook page for a behind-the-scenes look at Radio Times. It's a lot of fun. You'll find it at whyy.org/Radio Times, along with our podcasts. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moscawain on Radio Times.